From the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida, welcome to Indigenous in the News. I'm your host, Larry Kay from the Ho-Chunk Nation, along with Gary Wilcox from the Powhatan Nation. A direct threat to tribal sovereignty is unfolding, and most people don't even know it. This week on Indigenous in the News, Keaton Sunchild of Western Native Voice exposes the hidden provision in the U.S. Senate's 2025 budget bill that could sell off millions of acres of public land, including sacred Native sites. These sites hold our stories, our ceremonies, our foodways. Once they're gone forever. Indigenous in the News starts now. I'm Larry Kay, and joining us from our Miami studios is Gary Wilcox. How you doing, Gary?
Hey, I'm doing great. Doing great, Larry.
Yeah.
Today, we're honored to speak with Keaton Sunchild of Western Native Voice. He's here to discuss a buried provision that's in the U.S. Senate's 2025 budget bill that will force the sale of millions of acres of public land. Land that holds deep cultural and spiritual value to Native communities. Welcome to the show, Keaton.
Mm-hmm. Hello, Keaton.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yes, welcome.
So, Keaton, let's start with the basics. What exactly is buried in the Senate's 2025 budget reconciliation bill that possesses such a serious threat to Native lands and tribal sovereignty?
Yeah, good question. It's buried pretty deep in this already very big, messy bill. But this specific provision would allow a fast-track sale of up to 3 million acres of public lands that are in federal hands already. So this would open them up to private buyers, energy developers, business people, without any tribal consultation. So a lot of these lands include places that are under treaty rights, that have already been kind of set aside for tribal nations, sacred sites, traditional hunting, fishing, ceremonial grounds. It's a pretty dangerous precedent that would be set that would, deal a pretty big blow to tribal sovereignty, and just kind of show a complete disregard for our culture. And it's just straight up kind of gray area if it's entirely legal or not as well.
Right. What's your response to those who say the sale of 2 or 3 million acres is just a small percentage of federal land holdings?
Yeah, I mean, you look, grand scheme of things, it might not seem like a lot, but we're not really trafficking in percentages here. We're talking about places that go back generations in tribes, place-based identity, places where tribes survived on the land. This includes the sale of, potentially could include the sale of sacred sites, like I mentioned earlier. Just losing one sacred site is too many. It's not just acres on a map. It's places where my ancestors walked, where lots of listeners of ancestors walked. Lots of ceremonies still take place in these places. It's where languages were formed and passed on. And the logic that it's just a small slice or a small percentage just flat out ignores the spiritual, historical, and cultural impact that this potential sale would have on tribal communities.
Why is the exclusion of Montana from this land sale provision not enough to protect the indigenous communities across the West?
Indigenous culture doesn't really stop at state lines.
Right.
I'm from Montana, grew up in Montana, whole family is still there. But I'm over here in DC now, and I didn't stop, appreciating my culture, practicing my culture when I got here. Many tribal nations have historical and cultural ties that cross state lines, and some even, up into Canada or down into Mexico.
Right.
So spiritual sites that, might be in Montana or in Wyoming, as well as hunting lands, that may be ancestral, those impact tribal communities. And I think that kind of what's unique about tribal communities is We might all be scattered about the country and about around the world, but we're all still indigenous. We're all still
Well.
first people. And so, exempting Montana doesn't protect, Crow Nation when they go to Wyoming, and it doesn't protect, the Blackfeet if they go down to Utah. You don't just turn off being indigenous when you cross state lines. That's something that, you carry with you in your body and in your soul and in your heart, no matter where you're at.
What are some samples of sacred or cultural significant sites that could be lost if this bill passes, as is?
Yeah, as is. I mean, we're gonna lose some big ones. Off the top of my head, places like Bears Ears or the Medicine Wheel in Wyoming,
Man.
Chaco Canyon in New Mexico, or in Montana, we've got Badger Two Medicine. Those have always, I shouldn't say always, I'd say the last, about decade now, have been pretty heavily targeted for land transfers or for energy development reasons. And that's not to say that's an exhaustive or an extensive list of the sacred sites that could be sold off for whatever reason. But losing, like I said earlier, losing just one of those would be devastating
Right.
for tribal communities all across America and potentially all across the world.
So, how does the bill violate the federal government's trust and treaty responsibilities when it comes to tribal nations?
Look, we've gotten to a spot in our country's operations where tribal consultation really doesn't exist in the way that it should. It used to be meaningful. There used to be meaningful dialogue back and forth, and we're not really there anymore. It's an afterthought where we're, as Indigenous people, fighting for that consultation, and that's not how it should be. But, this bill undermines the entire legal foundation that treaties, going back since the beginning of this country, have been built on. Treaties are the supreme law of the land. They're not, suggestions. They're not, a speed limit sign. The federal government is legally obligated to protect tribal resources, legally obligated to consult with tribes, and legally obligated to uphold access to traditional lands. So the selling off of these lands without our consent or without our participation just flat out breaks those promises that were laid down, treaties agreed to, generations ago.
And how do you plan to attack that?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we unfortunately just have to keep almost being annoying to these, lawmakers, to lawyers, to the courts, like, hey, this exists for a reason. We can't just disregard the way things are supposed to be. Like, we still are a country of laws, and sometimes those are bent and stretched, and sometimes there's a time and a place for nuance, especially in the legal field, but this is one where it's very black and white. And so being able to, keep that in the forefront of every conversation, like, hey, these aren't suggestions, these aren't, an afterthought. This needs to be like at the top of any decision we're making. Like, is this something we need to be paying attention of? If not, great, we can keep moving. If it is, we need to figure out, not we, lawmakers need to figure out, okay, how are we going to have these conversations so that we're not, jeopardizing, what this country is based off of, basically.
What would losing access to these lands mean for traditional life ways like ceremony, food gathering, and spiritual connection?
Yeah, I mean, right off the bat, we're just going to be experiencing an extreme disconnect. Depending on where you're at, depending on when sales could or couldn't happen, ceremonies could be interrupted. The next generation, my younger cousins, eventually my kids, my sister's kids, they'll lose part of their identity that I had, that my grandparents had, that their grandparents had.
Absolutely.
We're losing our traditional life ways. You have the hunting, the gathering, praying, and relying on the land. We're one of the last groups of people that truly rely on the land, that live with the land. So when those are, fenced off, developed on, drilled into, it's not just an access problem at that point. It's severing a spiritual connection, and you can't replace that. You can't come back from that.
Do you see this as a part of a broader pattern of eroding tribal sovereignty in the federal policy decisions?
Absolutely. We're seeing this at a federal level. In my 5 years with the organization, I've seen it increasing at the state level, whether it's through pipeline approvals, lack of consultation on infrastructure. Just this past legislative session in Montana, we saw our state legislature just flat out vote against including a provision that requires tribal consultation for uranium and nuclear storage for energy. Just flat out said we don't
Wow.
need this. We've been dealing with that on a state level, and now, I mean, as concerning as it is on a state level, it's even more concerning on a federal level. Now we're, teetering into public land sales. Like I said, it's going to create a disconnect we can't recover from. So, I mean, it's just a continued pattern of sidelining tribal voices and tribal leaders, and erosion of legal practices or legal protections. And there's a lot of folks out there right now who think America should be run as a business. And as a result, tribal nations are being treated like stakeholders and not as the sovereign nations that they are. So, I mean, this bill that the Senate is working its way through is just the latest in a long line of action that's being taken, but it's potentially one of the most dangerous, because if this is able to go through without any sort of pushback, there might not be a stopping point in the near future that we can come back from.
Why is the lack of tribal consultation in this bill so dangerous? And what would the meaningful consultation actually look like to the public or otherwise?
Yeah, so consultation isn't just talk checking in with a tribal nation. Hey, we're gonna do this. The lack of consultation we're seeing has more to do with decisions that are being made about us, about the indigenous people as a whole, without us. It's looked at now as just a step, a check, a box you have to check. But it's a government to government relationship. The conversations that are happening between, the federal government and the Blackfeet tribe in Montana are no different than the conversations that have should be no different than the conversations that are happening between the United States and Canada. Theoretically, legally, they are the same. And right now, with how this process has played out, it's been radio silence, and we can't have that, which is why I'm glad people are starting to realize, hey, this is buried deep in here. This is bad. And yes, it's bad that public lands are being sold off, but it's also really bad that these public lands are closely tied to a very large community here in America, and it's going to impact them exponentially more than it might somebody else. And so when we fail to have those conversations, we are sending the indigenous community back potentially generations.
Yeesh.
Gave us fish, the woodlands gave us deer and other wild game.
This week, we're joined by Keaton Sunchild, Federal Director of Government and Political Relations for Western Native Voice. He's here to discuss a buried provision in the U.S. Senate's 2025 budget bill that could force the sale of millions of acres of public land, land that holds deep cultural and spiritual value for Native communities. Keaton breaks down what's at stake and how we can all take action to protect tribal sovereignty and sacred places. Contact Keaton directly at 202-464-3263. That's 202-464-3263.
What sort of legal recourse or treaty violations or anything, what legislative recourse do tribes have as far as the provisions, you know, to keep these provisions moving forward? Are they able to bring up treaty violations and things like that? Are they able to make that and enforce that?
Yeah, I mean, there's always that you like to have that in your back pocket as a last resort. Right. You know, right off the top, right now, continuing to keep pressure on all senators, but especially, you know, the key senators, and eventually, if this gets flipped back over to the House, key representatives, to amend or remove this land sale provision before, you know, it hits to President Trump's desk. And keep building that public movement. We've seen even right now where everybody seems to, you know, run to their respective ends of the spectrum. When there's enough noise being made, you'll see a lot of folks come back to the middle. And so we're hoping that, you know, that's the route we can get this taken care of. But if not, you know, worst case scenario, this is signed through and, you know, this goes into effect.
Is this part of that drill, baby, drill bill that he's got? Big, beautiful bill?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's got all sorts of tricks up his sleeve here to try to get this done. But no matter how it gets done, tribes do have the legal capability to challenge the entire bill or the provisions in court for violating treaty and trust responsibilities. So entire tribes can do that. Individuals can do that as well. Obviously, you're going to get more traction if you're a tribe. Just today, the Supreme Court issued an opinion about how these like preliminary and temporary injunctions are going to be viewed going forward. Now they're kind of going to be viewed in a way where if injunctions are granted and they're not permanent, it's kind of only going to apply to those who, you know, brought the suit. So for example, if a Montana tribe brings a suit forward and a federal judge grants an injunction, that won't necessarily protect tribes in Utah or Wyoming. So the only way to kind of get around that is to classify the lawsuit as a class action, which is where we would expect most tribes to kind of find themselves, is in a class action against the federal government for violating treaty and trust responsibilities. But it certainly, with today's Supreme Court opinion, got a little bit more difficult to explore that avenue, which makes it a little bit more scary.
You guys have like legislative runner or something that checks in with senators and things to try to see, you know, what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, we have, right now it's just me out here in DC. So we have folks that I work with on both the House and the Senate side, as well as with the Indian Affairs Committee, who do a pretty good job of keeping me in the loop. I do check in regularly with especially the Montana delegation, I'm kind of seeing where we're at. And then, you know, just really relying on the Indian Affairs Committee to give us an idea of, you know, who we need to be talking to at a given time or what things are coming down that we might need to be, you know, ready to kind of throw up a flag that we need people to, you know, raise their voices more than usual.
Right, right. What is your
showing up.
website?
Yeah, it's westernnativevoice.org.
Right on. westernnativevoice.org.
All one word.
Okay.
A long one. But yeah, and then just sharing your stories, you know, even if you don't maybe have the cultural connections that to the lands that indigenous tribes may have, you know, you might still, maybe that's where you grew up hunting with your dad, or maybe you went fishing there every summer. You know, those stories are important too. But I think it's important to, you know, not speak for tribes, but, you know, stand with us, you know, be side by side, be, you know, good allies, and recognize that, you know, this isn't just a native issue. This is about public lands. It's about accessibility for everyone. But at the end of the day, it's about democracy. If this is passed, if this provision is passed, there's really no telling where that line moves. You know, they could show the same disregard they showed for tribal sovereignty and tribal consultation to, you know, due process. There's no real telling where, you know, where the line in the sand then moves to. So, you know, realizing that, yes, this is a public lands issue. Yes, this is, you know, a outdoors, you know, thing that's happening right now, but the ramifications and the repercussions could be far, I hate to say it, but could be far worse if, you know, there isn't some sort of resistance put up.
How can our listeners take action today to protect tribal lands and support tribal sovereignty in this fight?
Yeah, same themes all the way through. Call your senators. They're the ones who have the provision, or the bill that has this provision in front of them right now. So call them. Talk to your local senators' offices. Every senator has local offices in major urban areas and some rural areas across the country. Even if they're here in Washington, D.C., there's still people at those offices back home. Talk to them. Let them know, hey, I don't think this is right. Share your story with them. Recruit people to your network. I know there's some online petitions floating around that I've seen on social media. You know, sign on to those. And if you're, you know, in Montana, or even if you're not, we have members from, you know, all across the country, some in Canada. You know, connect with us. We're on Facebook, we're on X, we're on Instagram. You know, you can go to our website and find all of our social media channels there. If you want to become a member, it's completely free, and we will provide you, you know, with resources, with, if you aren't sure what to say to your senator when they answer the phone or when their staff answers the phone, there's some talking points. If you're not sure, like, how the whole process works, we've got educational, you know, videos that kind of go over that. So, you know, finding groups, even if it's not us, you know, finding a group like us, finding a group that supports the correct transfer of public lands, at the very least. Obviously, we would love to keep those right where they're at in public hands, but, you know, sometimes you might not have that perfect group. We can't let perfection stand in the way of progress. So if there's somebody who's like, hey, you know, we think that there should be times where public lands are sold off, but this isn't right, you know, heck, join them. You know, whatever we can do at this point to stop this is better than nothing.
Right, right. Now, if this land sale provision is removed or reformed, what long-term steps should Congress take to ensure tribal nations are never sidelined in land decisions again?
Yeah, I think there has to be, before, I mean, you get into anything like in statute, there has to be a conversation, a reckoning of what tribal consultation is, what this government-to-government relationship needs to look like. And that's going to be hard in this climate. You know, there's a little bit of, we're playing fast and loose with legal decisions and what the law means these days. So, you know, depending on the makeup of Congress, you know, in after a midterm election in 2026 and into 2027, we might need to, you know, make new laws that would make tribal consultation mandatory and make it enforceable with penalties so that this doesn't feel like it's optional going
Yes.
forward. And another good step is restoring tribal land through land back policies. But not going to get into that whole thing now, but I think the thing that's going to help us the most is having indigenous voices at the table.
Yes.
Whether that is running for office yourself, whether that is working on campaigns, whether that is working in Washington, D.C. with senators, with representatives, or at a nonprofit or an organization that works to uplift, indigenous voices and shape indigenous policy. We need more people at the table, or else we're not going to be left
We're
behind.
in trouble.
I think it's time for us to get us a native president in office. That's what I think we need.
That'd be
Turn that White House into the Red House.
exactly.
Well, Keaton, thank you for stopping by tonight. I'm happy to have you on the show. This is a topic that we all need to learn and know. A big salute to you and your team for all the hard work you're doing, and I want to thank you for bringing this, again, important topic to light. And stay in touch with us and have yourself a great week. I want to invite you back again later on the show again.
Yeah, thank you guys. Yeah, I'm glad I got to talk about this, and hopefully some more people get involved from it, and hopefully we can chat again in a couple months, and we can talk about, wow, that was a scary time, but we made it, and
Yes.
we're better off because of it.
And how can they get a hold of you?
Yeah, so you can go to our website, which is again westernnativevoice.org. All of our contact info is there. For those of you who specifically want to get in touch with me, my office number in Washington, D.C., which comes straight to my cell phone as well. That number is 202-464-3263. So if you have any questions about what we just talked about, call me. If I don't answer, leave a voicemail. I get back to everybody within 24 hours. Or yeah, if you want to send an email, my email is on our website. It's a really long email address, so it's just easier if people
Look you
go to
up.
the
All
website and
right.
find me there. But yeah, happy to take phone calls, or if you're ever anybody's ever in DC and you just want to know where to start, give
Sure.
me a call or send me a message. Happy to show you around and help you out.
All right. Thank you, Keaton.
Thank you guys.
Take care. Thank you.
You guys too. Thanks. Be in touch.
Thank you for tuning in to Indigenous in the News and supporting us and our entrepreneurs. Indigenous in the News has been produced by Larry Kay. Our engineer is Paul Salvatore. Our theme music is composed by Lenny Long. Today's show has been recorded at the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida. If you'd like to support our program, you can stop in and donate at our homepage at indigenousinthenews.org. You can also find all of our past shows now on Spotify and iHeartRadio. Music today was from Tom B. and his band Exit, and that tune was At Peace. Until next time, from all of us here at Indigenous in the News, have yourself a great week and safe journeys. Indigenous in the News is a production of Indigenous in Music and Arts.